This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. This year marks the 50th anniversary of key moments in the civil rights movement, like Bloody Sunday and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. These anniversaries have sparked conversations around the country about the people, tactics, and ideas that shaped the movement. But journalist Charlie Cobb wants to draw attention to a lesser-known narrative, the role that guns played in keeping people alive. His book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible, explores the stories of individuals who used arms to defend themselves and others. Charlie Cobb is in town for a discussion at Bull's Head Bookshop at UNC Chapel Hill later this afternoon. But first, he joins me in the studio. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me here.
So what was the impetus behind this book?
Well, in a broad sense, my dissatisfaction with the historiography of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. As a reporter, I learned early in the work that people's perception of news is shaped as much by what's left out as by any bias that's in any particular report on broadcast or in newspaper. Same thing is true with the historiography. I think, and I was someone deeply involved with the movement, particularly in Mississippi, I think a lot has been left out. But thematically, for lack of a better word, what's the main thing that's left out is the fact, A, that the movement was lodged in rural communities, and that what defines the movement is grassroots community organizing in rural community, not protest marches, which is not to say protest marches and sit-ins were unimportant. I just think what drove the Voting Rights Act or what drove desegregation was the kind of organizing that unfolded in the rural areas. And in the rural South, an important piece of the culture is guns. People use them for hunting, to put food on the table, because a lot of these communities were poor. They use them to keep varmints out of the garden, or they use them for self-defense, black or white. And that kept us alive.
So you say that one of the reasons that you felt compelled to write the book, I mean, you were there. You were in Mississippi through this.
And I wanted to tell a particular story about the movement, the grassroots organizing story.
Well, let's talk about your own experience working as an organizer in the South. You were a SNCC activist. What was that experience like?
Well, for me, and I'm a native of Washington, D.C., to wind up in Mississippi, and I wasn't in the first Mississippi town I went to. It was 2 days after we got there when the mayor of the town stops us at gunpoint and tells us to get out of town. This is in Sunflower County, little bitty town, Ruville, 1,100 people in Mississippi. He says, I know you're here to cause trouble, and I'm here to tell you to get out of town. And he orders us in the car at gunpoint, his car. And when the guy I'm with, Charles McLaurin, says, why do we have to get in the car? The mayor says, cause this pistol says so. Now, coming from Washington, D.C., I'm saying, what universe have I wandered into? I don't think people today understand how violent many parts of the Black Belt South were in those days. It's alien to anything people experience now. It was very violent. And so the other component of my movement experience that stays with me is this tremendous and unexpected courage that I found all through the South. I mean, these people, older people, generally the people we work with were people the age of our parents and grandparents. And they would say, I'm not going to let these white people kill you, Charlie.
Let's talk about that. You spoke about it earlier, the difference between the civil rights movement in rural areas, Sunflower County in Mississippi is certainly a rural area, and urban areas. What was the distinction?
Well, to me, if I'm sitting in, say, in Atlanta, Georgia, or for that matter, Durham, North Carolina, I can make a very specific choice. I'm going to sit in, I'm going to take the abuse, I'll get beat up, or I'll wind up in jail or something like that. My choice. Or I can say I can't do that. I'm not going to do that. In the rural communities, the retaliation was collective. So if you're working in Ruleville, Mississippi, it's not just Charlie Cobb that's getting beat up or getting shot at. Knight Riders are shooting up the entire community. They're blowing up churches. They're burning homes. This is qualitatively different. it seems to me, than protest at lunch counters in Durham or Atlanta. And it affected me as an organizer and a lot of people who were organizing, because then you're confronted with the question of what's your responsibility to people who get hurt or killed because they're responding to what you're urging them to do. That question doesn't exist at a Woolworth lunch counter, but it exists in Ruleville, Mississippi.
A lot of this book is structured around the idea of the nonviolent civil rights movement and this rather one-sided idea that this nonviolence is what won the movement and this is why it was successful. But you kind of throw a little bit of a wrench into that idea that there was more behind nonviolence than just nonviolence. First off, where does the idea of nonviolence come from?
If you're talking about within the context of the United States and civil rights struggle, I would point my finger at one particular person, Reverend Howard Thurman, a legendary figure in black ministerial. So he's the one. He went to India in the 1940s, engaged in conversation with Gandhi, brought the idea of nonviolence back to the United States. Gandhi told him on his last day there that I'm quoting Gandhi, that it may be through Negroes in the United States that nonviolence reaches the world. Now, one of his students was Martin Luther King at Boston University. Another was James Farmer, because Thurman was the head of the Divinity School at Howard, where Farmer studied, and then he goes to Boston University when Martin King is there working on his doctorate. So he has a tremendous influence. His book, Jesus and the Disinherited, published in 1949, was like a revolutionary book. If you're a young black minister, you read it. And he's talking about not the typical Jesus, but Jesus, as a figure fighting Roman oppression. And it's pretty easy. So that's, I think, and this is an oversimplification, admittedly, because there are groups like the War Resisters League and the Fellowship of Reconciliation that affected people like Bayard Rustin. But so I acknowledge that this is an oversimplification, but I point to Howard Thurman as the single most significant figure in the way nonviolence made its way into black political struggle.
And how did different generations respond to this idea of nonviolence? Was it immediately accepted as, okay, we'll give this a shot?
Nonviolence is really not in the discussion of black civil rights struggle, really, until the Montgomery bus boycott, where King begins to articulate it. If Bayard Rustin was still alive, he would then chime in and say, because of me. But even then, as a way of life, it's never been that big in black communities, or I think in American communities. It's too hard. It's too dangerous. You have individuals for SNCC, the organization I was part of, Reverend James Lawson in Nashville, Tennessee, then is the key figure. He's the one that introduces nonviolence as an idea, both as a tactic and as a way of life to us, young people. And most of us took the position, well, it seems to work as a tactic if we're sitting in, but about this way of life, I don't think so. Except for that Nashville group that he was directly in, John Lewis was mentored by James Lawson. Diane Nash, James Lawson. James Bevel, mentored by, I think in the movement in general, it was seen as an effective tactic in certain circumstances. And it was not seen as being contradictory to self-defense. There were people in Mississippi who would tell you they're a part of the nonviolent movement as they're cleaning their rifles.
Well, that's the interesting thing, that you point out that there's a possibility, a real possibility, that the reason that the nonviolent movement could happen is because there were there were people around this nonviolent movement who were absolutely armed. They didn't have to use their gun, but they knew that they could. Yeah. And that in that way gave courage in some way. It gave the ability to go out there and stand peacefully.
As my friend Worth Long, who was a SNCC field secretary and a native of this city, Durham, North Carolina, said once, if they kill you, you can't be a good organizer.
I want to talk about something that is pretty interesting, and that's we're talking about the civil rights movement, but going back to what happened after World War I and World War II, and how it seems this put everything kind of in motion when you had African American men returning from not only fighting for their country, but seeing freedom in a way, fighting for freedom, and then returning to a South which put them back, you know, 100 years previous. What did those World War II veterans returning home do for the movement?
I give a great deal of attention to this in the book. In broad strokes, the veterans, the World War II veterans, and more than a million black men were servicemen during World War II. I think, and I make the case in the book, that they changed the climate of the South. They'd been overseas fighting Nazis and Japanese fascists and Italian fascists, killing them. They were not inclined to then come back to Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, or North Carolina and easily accept white supremacy. And if you look at the grown-up men who embraced SNCC and CORE, for that matter, kind of a new CORE because it's been expanded by an influx of young people, if you look at those men who embraced SNCC and CORE in the 1960s, a lot of them were World War II veterans. Meg Evers was a World War II veteran. Aaron Henry, the head of the Mississippi State NAACP, was a World War II veteran. Amzie Moore, who put voter registration on SNCC's table because we weren't thinking about it, was a World War II veteran. The Deacons for Defense and Justice that protected the CORE workers in Louisiana were largely World War II veterans. They have Martin Luther King's group. I could go on and on about yes. World War II veterans. And, of course, the language that surrounded the war, freedom, democracy, and all of this is going to affect black people who are fighting for this freedom and democracy in France or Germany or someplace.
You tell stories of particular communities throughout the book. One of them is the story of Monroe, North Carolina. Can you tell us about the role of the gun movement there?
Yeah, well, it was really the NAC. What happened, and this happened all across the South. I'm making a very complex story short. After the 1954 Supreme Court decision, you see a surge in the Ku Klux Klan. What Robert Williams did was organize an NAACP branch, mainly of World War II veterans, and they shot it out with the Ku Klux Klan. They thought this doctor, this black doctor, was really, because he was a surgeon, had money, had education, they thought he was the real leader of the NAACP. So the Klan had a big rally and then had a motorcade escorted by the police to attack Dr. Perry's house. And the word had gotten out in the black community, and Robert Williams and his people had dug in all around Dr. Perry's house, and they were wearing helmets. And when the Klan came, they just opened fire. And they could have killed them, but they clearly were not trying to because they were firing over their heads. But the Klan got the message we might get killed from people we've come to kill. And that kind of was the last of those Ku Klux Klan. In fact, the city of Monroe, the next day or the day after that, banned Ku Klux Klan motorcades. And Robert Williams went on to become, you know, kind of the great symbol, because he had this argument with Martin Luther King in the pages of this magazine, Liberation Magazine, nonviolence, self-defense, the two of them. So Williams kind of symbolizes that older group of guys, World War II veterans, as Williams was. And within the context of the quote, nonviolent movement.
The white KKK members wanted to scare people, but they didn't want to get themselves shot in any way.
And they wanted to terrorize people, and they claimed a firm belief in white supremacy, but they were not prepared to die
shot
for white supremacy. I mean, I understand that.
We've been speaking about these stalwarts of the civil rights movement, and they're all throughout your book and your chapters. I want to talk about Fannie Lou Hamer and what you think her story highlights about some of these hidden narratives of the movement.
Firstly, I was with Mrs. Hamer the first time she tried to register to vote in Sunflower County in Indianola. And what she represents is this strength that you find at the grassroots. That's what Ella Baker, another North Carolina native, and who more than any single person was responsible for SNCC, taught us. She always said, look at the grassroots, work from the bottom up. And Mrs. Hamer, here she is, a sharecropper, been a sharecropper all her life, sixth grade education, I think, first one to walk into the courthouse in Indianola to try and register to vote, got kicked off the plantation because of it, becomes a major figure in Mississippi's black leadership. It tells you what kind of strength exists at the grassroots if you look for it at the grassroots, which a lot of people don't. Mrs. Hamer said, with respect to guns, sort of famously, at least inside SNCC, she said, I keep a shotgun in every corner of my bedroom, and the first cracker tries to throw some dynamite on my porch won't write his mama again. This incredible strength among these people, and they're practically invisible in the canon or in the narrative.
I'm speaking with Charlie Cobb today on the state of things. How do you respond to the criticism that guns in a nonviolent movement is hypocritical? You can't have guns and call yourself peaceful.
Yes, you can. I mean, it's easy to respond to that. First, you have to think of black people as human beings. If you think of black people as human beings, they're going to respond to terrorism the way any human being is going to respond, and that is do the best they can to keep themselves, their family, their loved ones, their communities alive. This is just a human response. It's not in contradiction to nonviolence because you're not talking about aggressive guerrilla action against the sheriff or against the county courthouse. I think ordinary people, and that's what we're talking about. We're ordinary people, sharecroppers and small farmers and small businessmen and the like, respond not ideologically to some theory about nonviolence. And I think they would agree because they're all, for the most part, Christians and deeply involved. I mean, they all read the Bible and talked about Jesus and love and redemptive suffering, but
they want to keep their families safe.
They want to keep their families safe. And they took us in as members of their family. I mean, that's what we were to them. Even though we had come into those communities as organizers around voter registration, they saw us the way, because we talk about this a lot, you know, what we discovered as organizers was that we were not only part of a political struggle, but they really, we had become a part of a family in these communities. These people treated us, because they were our parents' age and our grandparents' age, they treated us like members of family and they want to protect us. I just don't see how that contradicts non-violence. As a friend of mine said, again from Mississippi, he said, sometimes I think the most non-violent thing I could do is to get a Winchester and shoot some of these Klansmen. Think of them as ordinary human beings, and the idea of it being contradictory just fades away in my way of thinking.
That's journalist and activist Charlie Cobb. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Charlie will be talking about his book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible, at Bull's Head Bookshop at UNC Chapel Hill today at 3:30. You can find out more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new food book from barbecue man Bob Garner about local favorites in North Carolina.